Thank you. Be seated. Justice Gonzalez has voluntarily recused in this case. The court is ready to hear argument from the late party. Union Pacific v. Clerk Court.
May the police report, Mr. Gonzalez de Arreal will present argument for the later. The later is adjourned 5 minutes to the court.
May it please the court. My name is Carlos Villavier, and I'm here for Union Pacific, along with me is Steve Rogers from Bryan. I'm from Corpus Christi. There are two doctrines historically by which a judge's ability or authority to handle a case can be challenged. One is disqualification, the second is recusal under Rule 18 and 18A. The standards for these different challenges are different. The standard for disqualification is under the Texas Constitution, Article 5, is if he's interested, if he has an interest in the litigation. The standard for recusal is if a judge's impartiality may reasonably be questioned. And the appellate remedy for the two different challenges is different. Disqualification motions that are denied have historically been challenged by mandamus, whereas recusal motions that are denied, the Rule 18A, subparagraph F, specifically requires that they be challenged by appeal using an abuse of discretion standard. The mandamus, the plurality opinion by issuing the conditional mandamus by Justice Chavez below mixes these two methods of challenging a judge's authority. And that is the problem, because the first issue that I think the court should come to is the question of, was mandamus appropriate? And consistent with this court's holding in Montalvo versus Fourth Court of Appeals, where a court of appeals has issued mandamus in a circumstance where there is an adequate remedy by appeal, that mandamus should be corrected by mandamus of this court. And that's what we have here. I think first and foremost, the clear-cut, bright-line procedural problem here for the plaintiffs is that they have obtained mandamus relief saying that the judge should have recused himself when such recusal challenge, or such challenge to the denial of recusal should only be brought by appeal. And there are a lot of good, obviously, policy reasons for having it that way. Every time a judge is presented with a recusal motion, he has an option to recuse or to refer it to the administrative judge for appointment of a judge to hear the recusal motion. So that's one option to recuse. Then that judge who is appointed to hear the recusal motion has two options, to deny or to grant. So if he grants, obviously there's the rule itself says there's no appeal. If he denies, then the rule specifically says your remedy is appeal. If that rule is not followed, then basically every time a judge denies a recusal motion, there are going to be mandamuses. In this case, it's further mixed up by the fact that disqualification was raised some 3 weeks after the judge had made the ruling denying the motion to recuse. And so one judge takes pains to say, well, the disqualification should have been considered by the judge who was appointed to hear the recuse motion. The plurality opinion saying that the judge should have raised the disqualification issue sua sponte. And there's a real problem with that holding and that conclusion. And the blending of these two standards and these two appellate remedies. You would have, basically, every time there's a close question on disqualification, the attorney pleading in the alternative, oh, but his impartiality may reasonably be questioned. If mandamus is to stay an extraordinary remedy, then this court, I think, should and will adhere to its mandate in Walker v. Packer and in many cases before, that there must be no other adequate remedy in law. Here, it is clear that there is an adequate remedy in law. The Waco Court of Appeals held as much in 1993 in Thomas v. Walker, and I think that this court recognizes and appreciates the need to proceed on appeal as opposed to mandamus in such recusal determinations. The next stage of inquiry, I think, is to take a look at the Court of Appeals' plurality opinion and to evaluate as to how the standard of review was misapplied. First, with regard to whether the court proceeded pursuant to guiding rules and principles. And this is curious because the plurality opinion says there were two hearings here on recusal. It was the first hearing at which Mr. Hermanson represented Union Pacific, who's my partner. He didn't cite any authorities, he didn't put on any evidence, and he basically made very little argument. Judge Blackman ordered recusal, and then I filed a motion to rehear, cited the court some nine cases, which I cited this court, that I think place into context and define the standard of whether a judge's impartiality might reasonably be questioned. The judge at the hearing, Judge Blackman, specifically said, I'm looking at those nine cases. Those cases help me put into context this issue of whether or not the judge's impartiality may reasonably be questioned. And I conclude, based on the evidence now presented at the second hearing and based on the case law, that this judge's impartiality may not reasonably be questioned. And that and denied the motion to recuse. The other thing that the Court of Appeals didn't do in its mandamus is there was no deference to the trial court's fact findings. Indeed, the plurality opinion cites the vacated fact findings that were specifically set aside by Judge Blackman to support their conclusion. And the other thing that the plurality opinion didn't do in its issuance of mandamus is that it did not review the entire record. If it would have reviewed the entire record, it would have cited, for instance, the true nature of the relationship at issue, which I'll talk about in a little bit, and denied the defendant's motions, and the fact is that Judge Bennett, who the motion to recuse was referenced to, had indeed denied all the motions the defense had made to that point. Motions to transfer venue, motions for summary judgment, that may be relevant to evaluating, if you're looking at the entire record, whether a judge's impartiality may reasonably be questioned. The fact that my firm had in the past represented other judges with similar situations involving belligerent attorneys challenging their orders. And the fact that Judge Bennett testified several times unequivocally he has no personal relationship with me, and indeed, to the contrary, he has a personal relationship with Mr. Edwards, plaintiff's counsel, for many years. He doesn't count me among his personal friends. He does count opposing counsel. How is the judge's impartiality reasonably to be questioned under those circumstances when the entire record is considered? I think that factually I should go through, and I skipped the factual discussion first, and maybe that's an error on my part, but what I wanted to do is I think that I put my finger on the problem with the Court of Appeals' analysis when I say there are these two different methods of challenging a judge's ability or authority, recusal and disqualification. They involve different standards, and they involve different methods of review by appeal. And because those two were mixed by just Chavez's plurality opinion, he came to the conclusion that there should be recusal. I think an appropriate analysis would first evaluate the recusal and conclude that the recusal motion is improper as a mandamus and should be brought on appeal. And secondly, on disqualification, I believe no judge specifically said that Judge Bennett should be disqualified. Judge Chavez phrased it in terms of whether he should be recused, but I think you used the disqualification standard. Four judges in the plurality actually agreed that there was no, quote, interest, as the Constitution uses that term for purposes of applying disqualification in this circumstance.
Should this court be interested or concerned or take note of Judge Bennett's taking an active role in the recusal, the second recusal hearing, making the request for rehearing and that sort of thing? Should that have any significance in the outcome of this case?
Judge, at the the disqualification issue and that conduct was not the basis for the motion to recuse. They sought to raise it by amended motion, which Judge Blackman, I think correctly, I think he was unfairly chastised for this, said, I don't have jurisdiction to consider that because that wasn't in the recusal motion that was referred to me by the administrative judge. So what the plaintiffs did is they went back and filed a second motion to recuse that included those bases. Nothing happened on that because the Court of Appeals, immediately upon receipt of this case, required the trial court to abate all action. And so the trial court has not done anything with that. Then the plaintiffs choose, and this is their election, to raise his participation at the hearing and to raise it, having sent Judge Blackman a correspondence immediately after the first ruling, as a basis for disqualification. Disqualification being fundamental error, I think, could properly be raised in the Court of Appeals if it would have been properly considered before. In other words, you can raise, disqualification was never considered before, but it was considered by the Court of Appeals because they raised it at their election. Because I think it is fundamental error, I think that you can consider the conduct for purposes of evaluating the disqualification, the constitutional disqualification issue. And I think that under all, at least under the
what you're saying is to the extent that the party that plaintiffs are urging that by taking an active role in the recusal process, this is an interest that would disqualify him. To that extent, then you think the Court of Appeals could address it. Your point being, though, you don't think that on a recusal issue, for the judge to take an active role in representing the judge against the recusal, that is a constitutional level of interest.
I think I think you're correct in restating it. The four judges, Judge Chapa included, concluded that there was not sufficient, that this was not the type of interest that would lead to disqualification. And that ruling, that part of the Court of Appeals opinion, is unchallenged. So we don't have, really, before this court, the disqualification issues. So I guess, to that extent, this court probably shouldn't consider that conduct if, insofar as it can only be raised by mandamus, that conduct can only be relevant to the disqualification issue, which can be raised by mandamus.
In your view, that's not relevant to bias or any other basis for recusing the judge, ultimately.
I don't think that it can be considered that way. I think if you do that, the real problem is that the can the judge's impartiality reasonably be questioned swallows up disqualification. Because whenever you've got a close issue on disqualification, Your Honor, someone's going to say, well, that's close enough to raise the whether the judge's impartiality may reasonably be questioned. And you can't have one rule swallowing up the other one, I guess is what I'm saying.
There's some federal decisions cited in the real party and interest brief. Can you distinguish those?
Yes, Your Honor. The federal cases that were cited by the plaintiffs first of all, one of them very clearly it's dicta. They say that they assume that in a situation where a judge is being represented by an attorney, that judge must recuse himself when that attorney appears in court. They said they assumed it, they didn't decide it, and indeed, the ultimate holding in that case, the mandamus was denied.
There's some cases where the judge filed a pleading in the recusal proceedings and testified.
I think it's Blanchard case. That's a state case, not a federal case.
The Craig decision.
I'm sorry?
The Craig decision. U.S. v. Craig.
U.S. v. Craig. Is that...
The 11th Circuit.
I'm not certain whether that's the one I just described to the court where I think it was indicative that they raised that. The Fifth Circuit case that they cite, I think it's Potashnik, deals with a whole slew of relationships, business relationships, former partnership relationships, continuing relationships in business that are obviously not pertinent here. I think that the legitimate distinction between personal representation and all the cases that they've cited in court involve a personal representation to the judge as opposed to representing the court. I am an officer of the court. I was called upon by this court as an officer of the court to prepare a mandamus because this court had, in my opinion, and obviously in Judge Bennett's opinion, unfairly and unjustly been attacked.
The decisions I'm talking about, when a judge more or less aligns himself with one side on the recusal motion, files a pleading, asks for a rehearing, goes in and testifies, hasn't the judge at that point in the recusal proceeding?
The Blanchard case is those facts, Your Honor. The Blanchard case, it was a state decision. It involved disqualification, not recusal. So again, that's a very critical distinction in terms of the propriety of mandamus. The other thing that was involved there is here Judge Bennett did not hire counsel. There that he hired counsel. Here Judge Bennett did not participate in questioning witnesses. There that he participated in questioning witnesses. And there the motion or the response that the judge filed had requested attorney fees. And here attorney fees have not, there's been no attorney hired, so there's been no attorney fees sought. The factual circumstances are very much different than the Blanchard case. I have cited to the court at least six opinions in which judges have testified at recusal hearings. And in each of those cases, the testimony of the judge can be characterized as being against recusal. And yet, that has not been found to be a basis for disqualification or recusal in those cases.
Well, that couldn't be, could it? Because the mere filing of a recusal, if it's at all contested, would involve involvement of the trial judge, wouldn't it?
I think that a judge is his testimony may be necessary in a recusal hearing, yes.
Any other questions?
Yes. Thank you. One more, please. I'm a little bit confused. I thought you had the first argument that disqualification wasn't properly preserved and therefore it's not an issue in this proceeding here, but then in answer to Judge Enoch's question, I got the impression you were saying yes, that it can be considered because
I think disqualification is going to be considered anyway because they filed a second motion, Your Honor. I think they raised
but
it.
But didn't you say it was never ruled on?
The disqualification issue was never heard at the trial court level because it had not been referred. But disqualification, being fundamental error, I think could be raised and was raised by the plaintiffs to the Court of Appeals. Now, as I say, and this is a very important distinction, four of the seven judges held disqualification is not available here because there is not the type of interest necessary to trigger a disqualification.
So your viewpoint,
and that has not been challenged.
You're arguing that you can get to the merits of the disqualification issue, and when you look at it, it's not the kind of interest the Constitution requires. Therefore, disqualification doesn't apply. But the second part of that is, if it's a disqualification issue that can be raised, that's properly a mandamusable issue, isn't it?
Yes, Your Honor.
So then I guess the question is, are they properly here because of what you're now arguing, as opposed to can't be here at all because they've got an adequate remedy on appeal on the recusal issue?
I think they can't be here at all on recusal. I think that disqualification could be raised at the Court of Appeals and was raised, and they lost. And it's not challenged, so I don't see how this court would consider it.
I see what you're saying. So the bottom line is all that this court should look at in your view is the recusal issue, and even if there was an abuse of discretion, the rule requires an appeal, and therefore the Court of Appeals was in error.
Yes, Your Honor. I think that accurately states the position. I would insist on noting that I do not think there was any abuse of discretion.
Well, but even you could say I will concede abuse of discretion, but be that as it may, this court can't say anything about it because it's an appealable. And I realize you don't want to do that.
I can't concede it, Your Honor. I think,
but it can't, should not be here.
Yes, Your Honor.
Oh, thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument and respond.
May it please the court, Mr. William Edwards will present argument for the respondents' real parties and interests.
May it please the court, My name is Billy Edwards, and along with my father, Bill Edwards, represent the real parties in interest. This case presents this court with the question of whether there can ever be a circumstance where an appellate court may properly issue its writ of mandamus to correct the improper denial of a motion to recuse the trial judge. Our answer to that question is yes. And the rule that we would propose is that if recusal is established as a matter of law and recusal is nonetheless denied, then mandamus should issue. In terms of what rises to the level of establishing recusal as a matter of law,
Mr. Edwards, do I then understand your argument to be that you recognize what the existing rule is and you recognize what the existing law is, but you want this court to change it by saying what you're purporting to argue here?
I'm putting forth that suggested rule because I do not think there's any written rule in the Texas cases at this point on that point.
Has there ever been another case where a denial of recusal was corrected by mandamus rather than by...
My review of the cases show me that there have been petitions for writ of mandamus filed following the denial of a recusal. Sitting here answering your question, my recollection is that those cases generally held that there was no abuse of discretion.
But they did treat it on the merits.
I think that there is at least one, if not two, original proceedings where they determined that there was no abuse of discretion.
Those may be in your brief.
Yes.
If they're not, would you?
I will certainly find them for you. What establishes recusal as a matter of law, especially under Rule 18b-2a, that is, where the trial judge's impartiality might reasonably be questioned. And our answer to that would be that when the purpose of Rule 18b-2a would clearly be defeated in the absence of recusal, then recusal is established as a matter of law.
There's already a concern, a growing concern at the bar and among the public, because I'm getting calls about it, that recusal is being used for delay purposes at a much, really a geometrically accelerating rate than it was used when the rules were first promulgated. And if we were to set up a system that said a denial of recusal could be reviewed, albeit however high the standard is, wouldn't someone who was just filing the initial motion for delay purposes always seek to take advantage of any mandamus rule, no matter how narrow? Simply, if they get two steps up, that's going to take a little more time.
Sure. I think there's a couple of answers to that. First of all, even if this court writes that there is not a review by mandamus, if you've got a lawyer that's out there just thumbing his knows at all the rules anyway, he's likely to go ahead and file the petition for writ of mandamus, regardless of what this court writes.
But there's some sanction. If it's an absolutely clean rule, there's some sanction rules. If it's not clean, if there's an exception, then ingenuity can generally find a way to make a colorable.
I agree with you. But that takes me into my next point, which is the rule that I suggested, that if the purpose of Rule 18b-2a would clearly be defeated if recusal is not granted. My suggestion to you was going to be that that alone is not a nice, clean mathematical equation to give the lower courts. But there would be two guiding principles that would help lower courts, lower appellate courts especially, determine whether or not mandamus was appropriate. And I think that these two guides would also help enforce by sanctions frivolous petitions for writ of mandamus. First of all, the purpose of the rule as stated, and what I'm doing is adopting some of the language from the federal courts that have explained what the purpose of Section 455 is, the federal equivalent of our Rule 18b-2a. And the purpose being to to promote the public's confidence in the impartiality and integrity of the judicial process, to promote an unwavering confidence in the integrity of the judicial system, and to protect the dignity and integrity of the judicial process from any hint or appearance of bias. The second guide will necessarily be, I think that we can all foresee that if this court adopts this rule, somewhere some lawyer is going to file a motion to recuse on the basis that 3 months before they file their lawsuit, the trial court, the trial judge went duck hunting with the brother, the partner of opposing counsel. And the motion for recusal likely will be denied, and that lawyer will file his petition for a mandamus. Whether it's because he sincerely believes that the judge, that he has established recusal as a matter of law, or whether it's just a delay tactic, he files the writ of mandamus, and either the Court of Appeals or this court can very quickly write that this is not what we meant by establishing recusal as a matter of law. That in this case, there are clear circumstances where there is a special relationship between the judge and one of the opposing law firms, and conduct on the part of the judge that aligns the judge, and where the judge has become an advocate for a position taken by one of the parties. Those are the types of circumstances that we're talking about, where the purpose of the rule would clearly be defeated if recusal is not mandated.
How long did this last? I mean, Mr. Villarreal is counsel for a judge, or any lawyer is counsel for a judge in a proceeding, and ultimately that proceeding is how long does that, the fact that that relationship existed, how long is that grounds for recusal?
I have heard that the federal courts have got a time period that they've got, and I don't know if it's formal or informal. In the context of this mandamus, I would suggest this, that for it to be established as a matter of law, if you're going to try to establish recusal as a matter of law on the basis of attorney-client relationship, that it must be while the case is pending in the trial court. And perhaps that is one bright line that will help. If it's before, if there was some representation before the lawsuit that is pending, perhaps that is one of the that is an issue that will necessarily fall within the discretion of the judge hearing the motion to recuse, rather than saying that is something that establishes recusal as a matter of law.
But suppose that, you got the trial judge serves in Oasis County, hundreds, thousands of lawsuits. Any trial attorney there has probably got a case pending there. Now, which lawyer is going to step forward and represent the judge in a recusal for fear that they are then setting up grounds for that judge to be recused in any other case pending in that judge's court?
Well, first of all, and I don't know if it was a, you made reference to a lawyer that would represent the judge in a recusal. First of all, it is our position that the judge should have no involvement in the motion to recuse, aside from perhaps being a fact witness, if called by one of the parties or the trial court hearing or the trial judge hearing the recusal, perhaps calling the trial judge as a fact witness, but certainly not having the judge take a adversarial position in the recusal.
That's a nice clean rule, but in some of our larger counties, there are some judges who are more popular with both attorneys than others. There's some forms of attorneys just try to avoid for whatever reason. And under this rule, a recusal motion was filed, there'd be really, the judge wouldn't be able to come in and defend himself or herself as a duly elected official who is entitled to have a docket by the rule of the beast.
But, Rule 18B envisions that the trial judge will not be involved at all in the recusal matter because it sets out the procedure that if the trial judge determines that he should be recused, the trial judge can recuse himself or herself. But if the trial judge is not going to recuse himself, then it is referred to another court.
Is this a disqualification case at all, or is this a, you haven't mentioned disqualification.
We recognize that the writings of this court and other courts of the state have traditionally written that for the judge to have an interest in the case that constitutionally disqualifies the judge, that it must be a direct pecuniary interest in the outcome of the case. I would suggest to this court that the cases do include language about a pecuniary interest or a personal interest. And I don't think it would be outside the boundaries for this court to review those cases and especially review the language about personal, showing a, or a, having a personal interest in the outcome of the lawsuit. Because I think that Judge Bennett in this instance in the recusal hearing clearly showed that he had some interest in the outcome of the recusal matter. Now, I can't put my finger on what exactly.
Well, that's different than having an interest in the outcome of, quote, the case.
But it is an interest in the outcome of one of the issues that is disputed between the two parties.
Sure, any judge has already refused to voluntarily excuse doesn't think he should be recused.
Well, see, I guess...
And call him involuntarily, you know, as a witness in the recusal hearing and say, Judge, should you be recused? He's going to say no.
Well, I know it, but perhaps that wouldn't be the appropriate question. I have not sat as a judge. And the closest I get to being a judge is sitting on the grievance committee back home. I do sense the trial judges take motions to recuse personally, as if it is a personal affront. The rules don't contemplate that. And remember that what we are talking about is the public's unwavering confidence in the integrity of the judicial system. We're not talking about the trial judge's feelings.
I understand the standard you set out, I think. But just to be blunt, in light of the way our judges get to be judges and stay there, isn't it a little schizophrenic to say somebody who represents you when the court has been challenged and at your request is a disqualified you from sitting in their cases or their firms for some period of time, but somebody who gives you up to $5,000 or $30,000 from their firm, and some of that money you spend on a campaign is paying off, and some of it's left over, and you can decorate your chambers with it.
Sure.
That's okay.
Well,
and once we say that's not okay, and that, shall we say, doesn't promote public confidence and integrity or protect the dignity and integrity from any hint of bias, then our judges are out there. They don't have anything to do with it.
I understand, but I will suggest this to you. If you go back and look at every opinion that has confronted the issue of campaign contributions and recusal, every time it's written about, the judge who writes the opinion says, I don't like this.
Well, you know,
I don't like it, but it is a necessary part of our system, and so we can't make this a basis for recusal.
You're familiar with Judge Barajas, to the contrary, in El Paso, albeit a dissent. But, I mean, that standard for a trial judge would essentially, I mean, we either set up a standard, which is just highly schizophrenic, that says we want our judges to be absolutely beyond repute and as pure as driven snow, except for this one big gaping hole, or we try to come up with a consistent standard and it leaves judges with no work.
I don't know what to tell you, Judge.
I know.
The rule is there.
Don't we have
the rule is there.
Have to temper all of our rules? I mean, when we look at a federal standard or something, don't we have to temper it all in light of the realities that the legislature has left us with?
Yes, absolutely. And I would only say this, that we can very much look to the federal cases and their interpretation of 455, with one clear exception of dealing with reality in a state where state judges are publicly elected and rely upon private contributions. We cannot start looking at whether or not private contributions create an appearance of less than impartiality or something less than impartiality, because as a public policy we have in this state a system are just as a matter of reality. We have in this state a system by which judicial races are funded by private contributions.
Mr. Edwards, let me take you back just a minute. The rule you propose is that if recusal is established as a matter of law and denied, then mandamus should issue. If we were to adopt that rule, would we also have to amend Rule 18AF, given its requirement or its language about appealing in an abuse of discretion standard?
I don't believe so, because first of all, there's the standard in a petition for writ of mandamus is still going to be abuse of discretion. And as the rule I put out is, if it's established as a matter of law, there is no discretion left. There is only one result that can be reached. With respect to the rule that says, that talks about appeal, it is permissive. It may be appealed.
It may be reviewed for abuse of discretion on appeal from the final judgment.
Yes.
And you're proposing that mandamus should be available in these kinds of procedures. This seems to be a rule that acknowledges that there is an adequate remedy on appeal. So my question to you is, that's why I'm asking you, does that rule need to be amended to adopt this new rule that you would like for us to follow?
I don't believe so. This court recently, and I'm just now thinking of this in response to your question, and so I don't have it the case exactly on the tip of my brain, so to speak, but y'all had a case where you didn't have jurisdiction over the interlocutory appeal, but you decided that you did have jurisdiction to consider a petition for writ of mandamus that raised the same issue. So in response to your question, I don't think that allowing a very limited avenue for petition for writ of mandamus conflicts with that rule. If there's going to be any amendment to that rule, I would suggest that it be one that says that it can be reviewed on appeal for abuse of discretion, but the harmless error rule will not apply, because that's one of the bases on which we say there is no adequate remedy by appeal, because if you apply the harmless error rule, you must show harm. And to show harm, you have to show that the judge's conduct or the judge's rulings were as a result of bias, and you completely defeat the purpose of 18b2a, which is dealing with the appearance of bias rather than actual bias.
Why does this particular case rise to the matter of law status as opposed to a case where there may be fact issues relevant to the recusal issue under your new standard?
Because of the special relationship that currently exists and now exists between Carlos Villarreal and his firm and Judge Bennett. And secondly, secondly, because of Judge Bennett's active participation and advocacy in the recusal matter, and in particular the letter that he sent asking for a rehearing.
Would you answer Judge Phillips' question? Is this a disqualification case at all? Yes or no? And you responded to it, but you didn't answer it.
I know it. I want to say.
Oh, you did? I want to talk to you, Mike.
I tried to answer a conditional yes, in that obviously all the prior cases that have held the judge is disqualified under the Constitution said it is because the judge has a direct pecuniary interest in the case.
But from the context of the other side's argument, that's not preserved and wasn't and not argued.
Mm-hmm. I think it is preserved. For one thing, it can be disqualification can be raised at any time. Secondly, we did try to file a trial amendment, and I think that under
but it's already been denied. That argument's been denied by the court of appeals by at least four of them.
I will agree that at least four of them wrote on it. The holding of the court and the judgment of the court is that Judge Blackman grossly abused his discretion in failing to recuse Judge Bennett.
When you're talking about a personal interest, that would be in the underlying case, not in the recusal.
It depends on whether or not you consider the recusal a part of the case, that is, an issue between the two parties which is opposed by the two parties. It's only a part of the case. It's not the whole case.
Any other questions?
Yes, one more. Your response to Judge Hankins' question about your proposed rule and how it operates is within the context of 18B2A.
Yes, I think it would apply to the rest of the specific parts.
But that's what your argument's been this morning.
Yes. Since we are dealing only with 18B2A, yes.
So it's a proposed rule, as I understand, would be if you can determine as a matter of law from the fact that there is a question about propriety, and that's a question as a matter of law, therefore you can mandamus the trial judge's decision.
Yes, if it will clearly defeat the purpose of the rule.
Now, what part of the process does making that decision focus on? The facts that the trial court decided, or how the trial court applied the law to the facts that he decided?
I think that the trial court, I think that the direct answer to your question is the application of the law to the facts, because if there is a disputed fact issue, then I suppose the trial judge hearing the motion to recuse is going to have to resolve it, i.e., is the judge represented, or is the attorney currently representing the judge, or is the attorney not currently representing the judge? And in this instance, it is undisputed.
Now you're again focusing on the representation issue as opposed to the assertion that Judge Bennett improperly involved himself in the recusal procedure.
That also is undisputed. It is undisputed what he did and how he did it.
So the answer is we're looking at the second part of the process, and that is, did the court properly apply the law to the facts that were found? And your assertion is, under your rule, no, therefore it's a matter of law, you can mandate.
Correct. Our position is that when there is an attorney, an existing current attorney-client relationship between the judge and an attorney representing one of the parties during the pendency of the lawsuit, that as a matter of law,
well,
establishes
it's still different what you're in your argument. If I understood your argument, you have two prongs, representing the judge, and the judge actively participates in the recusal procedure on his or her own. That's the two elements that you state, but you keep going back to prong one only.
What is
your position?
What I'm intending to say is that either one or both together. I'm saying that the attorney-client relationship alone during the pendency of the lawsuit.
So your rule is not quite as bright line as you would argue.
I did not mean to insinuate that you need both to get there as a matter of law, that one or the other will establish it as a matter of law.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Your Honor, just to directly answer Justice Baker's question on the fourth vote, Justice Chaffa's opinion reads, this record reflects insufficient evidence to establish that Judge Bennett had either a pecuniary or personal interest in the outcome of the underlying case, which would justify constitutional disqualification. That's the fourth vote. That's on page 9 of that. Much has been said about the relationship between me and Judge Bennett by opposing counsel. And I wish the court would take a little time to consider what's going on, because it is not a situation where Judge Bennett is being sued under 1983 or for sexual harassment, or where there is a car wreck accident against the judge and I'm representing the judge. That's not what's going on. I was called upon as an officer of the court to prepare a mandamus by that court in support of that court's order sanctioning an attorney.
We're familiar with
an obligation which I have under the lawyer's creed to protect the judiciary against unjust attacks and to preserve the dignity and the independence of the court, which was being challenged by a belligerent attorney. an obligation I have as a member of the bar to self-police because it involves sanctions against an attorney who had been engaged in misconduct. Justice Enoch's point, I think, should be well taken. What's going to happen when judges need lawyers? And this is not, I think this court need not write about a typical representation circumstance. I think that should be preserved for another day. I think this
is... I thought you wanted an absolute clean rule.
I wanted a clean rule on, and I think it is a clean rule, on this should be by appeal only and not by mandamus on the recusal challenge, Your Honor. That
I
think
I thought you didn't want our... Do you want our opinion? If we were to write...
If you get there, this is kind of... This is what I want. This is what I want to be considered. There is no confidentiality between myself and Judge Ben. We have given them the entire file. We've given them every communication. I feel that I am representing the 319 for purposes of enforcing the order. The brief that I provided would have been exactly the brief that would have been prepared by a real party in interest if there would have been one. There was not one because Mr. Hilliard did not serve the defendants in that case, and then filed a notice of non-suit, so they had no interest in enforcing the court's order. So basically, the court was getting pounded upon.
Putting that piece of it aside, they're also complaining that once the refusal was filed, Judge Bennett actively, and from an objective view, took sides on the refusal. He asked for rehearing, he asked to be heard, he asked the court to participate. He got on the stand and testified, saying, "I shouldn't be refused, here's why." If they're saying the standard is objectively was the judge still impartial, doesn't that create some question of impropriety or a lack of partiality in an objective view or something?
It doesn't break the basis for disqualification.
How about recusal?
That's the proof that they're arguing for disqualification. For recusal, that has not truly been presented. That has not been that basis to say the trial judge, he should say to Judge Blackman, Judge Bennett should be recused because he's here, Judge.
So, all right, we send it back, say immediately file a motion to recuse and say Judge Bennett has taken sides in this case. We're back in this suit.
Then I think the judge considers that evidence. And I think that an abuse of discretion standard would definitely support Judge Blackman's ruling if it were against the recusal motion because he's there. He's judging the intensity of this judge in terms of how actively he's participating against a recusal motion. As I said, I've cited to the court six cases where judges are testifying against recusal. It's just the fact that they wouldn't think that they shouldn't be recused, otherwise they would have just recused themselves, which was their option under Rule 18A, before they referred it to the administrative law office. So all of those judges that are testifying against recusal, all those judges have an interest in that litigation. As Judge Enoch said in Roger Bradley, that all judges have an interest in protecting their docket, and they have an obligation to do that. And that's why Judge Bennett was here.
He was
there to protect his jurisdiction.
Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument. In the second clause, the court will now take another brief recess.
All right.